Firstly, a fantastic observation made by Numi about the potential that the sport needs to tap into with regard to people that will never see the cars in the metal, and that primarily is their market. And if the sport's idea of spreading and dominating as a brand and as a product is going all over the world, the fastest way to do that is digitally. And no one owns the digital space more than content creators, whether that's on like a professional or just hobbyist level.
Listen, it's a great sport at its best, and I'm not exactly 100% sure whether this weekend was its best or if it was something that is just lulling us into a sense that it would be at its best. Of course, I'm talking after the 2023 Qatar Grand Prix. Today with us, we've got Ooh, Prince Ndiweni, Nonqumi Samti. Thank you guys for joining us. I'm really, really looking forward to this conversation with the both of you. But I guess introductions first thing first. Nqumisa, good evening. And can you just introduce yourselves to the listeners of this DRS Open podcast, please?
Hello, my name is Numi Samti. I'm 20, about to be 21. And I am a fan of Formula One, but other motorsports as well. I started watching in 2013. So yeah, it's been a long up and down journey, especially as a Sebastian Vettel fan.
Oh wow. Yeah. You said, tell me you're a Sebastian Vettel fan since 2013. I have to ask you about Multi 2-1 and everything around that. How did you that's quite a season to come into the sport. Actually, I think it has quite a lot of similarities to 2023, now that I think about it. It was a season where Sebastian Vettel won 9 in a row. Where the Red Bull absolutely just stormed to victory towards the end of the season. I'm jumping a bit all over the place, but you were a new fan in 2013. If I can ask you, what kept you interested? One might have thought that, well, you see one team winning 9 races in a row, your first season of watching the sport, what kept you engaged?
So my first Formula One memory is Multi 21. And I was like, who is this villain guy that everyone is like so upset with when he didn't really do anything wrong?
He did a
So
lot
I
wrong
think from there, I
that
like
day, but
so from there I kind of like took him under my wing. I was like, this is my Sebastian, I need to protect him because everyone hates him so much. And it's always fun to watch a sport
okay.
when your favorite is dominating. So it was boring, I guess, watching him win 9 in a row, but it's always like, damn, that's like my guy winning 9 in a row. Yeah.
Sure.
I enjoyed listening to the German anthem, I can't lie.
Fair, and it is a banging anthem. Very, very, very honest about that. Our second guest, Prince. Prince, I won't lie to you. My first interactions with you, my first encounters of you, were within the motorsport media landscape. But there's more to you than that. Can you please introduce yourself to the listeners of the pod tonight?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to be here. So basically my exposure to motorsports, my journey began with karting actually. So in 2011, 20 yeah, late 2010, early 2011, I began volunteering pretty much as a mechanic at Kyalami before it was the glitz and glamour you see it as today. One of the leading karting teams was based there, so I walked up Yeah, I walked up to them and pretty much asked, okay, what is this motorsport thing? Because I have no history of motorsport in my family whatsoever. I'm literally like the first generation, so to speak, that's taking an interest into the sport and the hobby. So yeah, I asked them what it's about and took it on from there, and then eventually became a mechanic when I caught on to a few skills. Over time, that turned into me racing in four strokes, much slower versions of the 125 shifter carts, etc., that you have. But that then also progressed into catching the attention of VW, because around 2016 and 2017, they had a driver search, as I'm sure you know, or you may have seen, and they were looking at the time for someone who would continue the legacy begun by Kuku Zulu. And Jonathan Mokgosi was one of the talents that came out of that. I was in that first and second year. And apart from the driver assessment part of it, there was also a media side of it that was being tested and honed with the talents that were found. And I stood out to VW and the people there during the time. And that turned into then a radio thing. I got exposed to the radio media side of things, a couple of filming productions as well in motorsport, and I've been in that space since then, pretty much. And whatever's come my way, I've just taken on and run with it in a sort of similar way to how I got introduced to karting. So that's basically my background.
That is flipping amazing, and I think I'm really struck by the point that you make about starting off in mechanics as a mechanic rather, and and the many different spheres of motorsport that you've touched. Because I think we are a Formula One podcast, but we are at our core about motorsport and trying to help people see various opportunities, particularly in South Africa, right, for the whole entire motorsport ecosystem. And I think you're someone who's definitely touched all of that. I think that's absolutely amazing. But I have to then ask you, as someone who's driven, you've been in a team dynamic, we can't not start off this conversation with turn one, lap one, Qatar. The lights go out.
Oh, geez.
I can only describe it as, I think the first three guys, we had a dynamic where Verstappen and Russell were starting first and second on the medium tire. We had seen from the Saturday sprint that the soft tire was pretty much jelly after 5 laps, so not a good race tire, but the launch that it gave everyone, and the restarts that we saw under the three safety cars on Saturday told us that the soft tire was undoubtedly the tire to, if you want to start a race, start it on, except you can't start and whip them off without taking a pit stop. But nevertheless, Mercedes decide to do this with Lewis Hamilton, and we'll get into the complexities of the race and the oddities of that. But of course, they come together, turn one, lap one. You have a situation where they're three wide into a corner. Hamilton's rear right clips Russell's front left. What did you make of that? I think I have to ask what you made of that.
It's the typical scenario, I guess, going into any turn one of any circuit in any Formula One race. I think first and foremost, the adrenaline's pumping, and it's a lot of the time instinct that is at play. Specifically for turn one, I'd say more than any other section of the track that follows after that. I think turn one will set a precedent for whatever's coming at you. And from there, drivers decide whether or not you're sticking to the precedent you may have established going into the race, or you're adapting to the new situation now, which in the case of Mercedes was the fact that Lewis Hamilton had a significant advantage, obviously, with the softs and a good run on the outside. George also a very good run on the inside, given the slipstream from Max. But the situation changed when George saw how much of an opportunity he actually has to threaten a little bit more. Now, it seems like a gray area as to what the discussion was with the two of them as to who has the run on who going into turn one. But it's pretty obvious on paper because the softs were pretty much, as much as they were melting off rims, in the sprint race, you knew they were the better tire to go for in the start. So you would naturally assume that Lewis was the priority driver. And that's what I think may explain just why he was so aggressively swinging into that right to close that door, or what George thought was a door, so aggressively, because it was uncharacteristic of someone so experienced to be. It looked very, very aggressive, you know, and which is why he definitely can take fault in the majority, I'd say, of the fault in the incident because of how much he moved across. But equally so, George having his nose in between Lewis and Max's car, also questionable if there is a context of them discussing who has the upper hand at the start, you know. So it's not a thing where it's a clear cut. We know who was wrong. We know who was right based on what we see on track. It's questionable as to what they went in expecting and discussing with the team. Based on what they went on and said to the media, particularly George saying that there was a discussion about who takes the run out of the beginning. So it's like, what is the team doing to manage situations like that from the jump? Because clearly it gets thrown out the window in one way or another going into, for example, turn one at Qatar, you know? So I don't know if that is not even as simple an answer to the question you gave me. What the heck are Mercedes doing is my answer to your question.
No, but I think in the spirit of that, and Lumisa, I'd love to get your thoughts on this particular incident as well, because I think the question that you're asking about what are Mercedes doing has been in my mind for quite some time. Now, you know, when we discuss these things, people have different philosophies. We have different things that we appreciate in a team. I know that Red Bull, for instance, are often chastised for giving team orders, particularly in race situations. Of course, you can't necessarily say team orders on lap one, turn one. I mean, that's an impossibility. But the general philosophy about, guys, let's stay out of each other's trouble. We're in this as a team. Mercedes tends to have a more sort of let them race approach, which is counter, again, I think, to what you're saying about the fact that they say that they discussed the possibility of this. And in my mind, should very reasonably have known that this was going to happen, insofar as that Lewis was going to get a much, I think they should have known that. And I think if Lewis had just stuck it out for maybe 30 more seconds, hung out around the outside, he would have led that race by turn two. Lumisa, do you have any thoughts on this? What are your reflections on a coming together of teammates that we, by the way, haven't seen at Mercedes? I haven't fact checked this, but apparently since 2016.
They did have a very close encounter in Japan. It was kind of a similar move-ish from Lewis, but George was able to avoid it in Japan. I think it's a lot like, if you remember Russia 2019 with the Ferraris, where they had discussed the fact that Seb could get ahead at the start, and then once he did, they kind of like fell apart. They didn't know what to do. But I think with Mercedes, what we're seeing is, because it's kind of been building up, there's been like a simmering like tension or something. As much as they like say online or say to the media or whatever that they're close or what they're fine with each other, I think what we're seeing is, so George, when he came into this team, I think he thought, Lewis is not going to be here for much longer, and I'm going to have time to build this team around myself. And now that Lewis is staying and Lewis is still as good as he is, he's kind of like becoming frustrated because the team isn't his. Like the vision of the team that he had before going in is not like what's coming out. So I think that's what a lot of the tension is, where like Lewis is like, this is my team, you're coming into my team. And George is like, but you're supposed to be gone. Like,
like, why are you still here?
Exactly. Aren't you and old? I think they're amicable. They work well as teammates. But there is definitely like a tension there. And I think I can't lie, I don't think this is the last time we'll be seeing them coming together, because they are so like equal on pace. They're going to be sharing the same part of track a lot of the time.
I think that's true. I think the Russia 2019 example is a brilliant one. And I also agree that for as long as, I think, first of all, last year, slightly simmered by the fact that yes, George Russell knew that he was coming into a team where he was to learn and sift all the knowledge of, you know, possibly the greatest driver of all time. I know that possibly in there is going to get me into a lot of trouble, but please bear with me. And he's now at a point where Lewis Hamilton has extended his contract through to 2025 and is talking like a man who could go past 2025. I think, you know, looking at Fernando Alonso, how old is he? Is he 41, 2?
40, yeah.
And I think Hamilton has looked at that. He's in much better shape. I think the decision that Hamilton made to go vegan all those years ago and just changes to lifestyle has created incredible longevity in him. And Russell must be rattled by that, coupled by the fact that he's being beaten by, at least before this weekend, 74 points, I think it was, in the Drivers' Championship. It's quite interesting, because you would think that Mercedes, given the Rosberg-Hamilton tension, would have learned from it. But there's another train of thought that says, well, they didn't actually learn from it. They just let it end organically, which was, you know, helped by Rosberg retiring. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think Prince, again, I'm also with you in that it's a situation which perhaps could have been avoided. But, you know, ultimately, these guys are super, super fast. And maybe you're the person I should be asking this, because I've often said I've never raced before. And I know that you mentioned some karting experience. And sometimes drivers will do things where I think to myself, you know, why weren't you thinking about this? Or why wouldn't you have anticipated someone out there? Do you think Russell expecting Hamilton to be on his outside, do you think it is reasonable for me and for us as fans to criticize him for that, which is to say, listen, Hamilton did get tight, but he should have known he's probably going to be there?
It's an absolutely fair assessment, because going into turn one, you just need as many rational precautions as possible, because you just don't know what's going to happen. If you're going to be relying on your instinct or your adrenaline into what turns into possibly the smallest patch of tarmac in Formula One very quickly, which is turn one, with 20 cars descending on it, you're not going to come off very well after that. So you definitely need some sort of logic that's guiding you around that. And that applies both to Lewis and George. I think Lewis, like you said, had he eaten more into that stretch on the outside, his chances of gaining on Max would have been increased significantly. So you definitely have to have some sort of expectation that Lewis, first of all, has soft tires. Let's go back to that fact. I think all logic was just thrown out the window. A significant chunk of the logic was thrown out the window where both George and Lewis were concerned. And in the case of George, he threw out that expectation entirely of Lewis being there, or, which often happens, didn't mind putting his elbows out and saying, look, if Lewis does see my left tire out there, he'd have to acknowledge it and give me space, you know? Or if, let me put it this way, if the racer on the left-hand side of me, if it's not a thing directly related to Lewis, if any car beside me sees me going relatively close to Max Verstappen, they're going to make way for me, which I think is the instinct that takes rule over George or any driver in that instance, in that particular moment. So he definitely had to be and was, I think, significantly responsible for being aware of Lewis. And in that instant, he wasn't.
Sure. And this is the last one, Prince, in 10 seconds. A lot of people I've seen on social media today have tried to draw some equivalence between this incident and the infamous Verstappen-Hamilton incident at Silverstone 2021. Do you see any similarities at Silverstone? Yeah.
Absolutely. It's the same modus operandi. It's just the collateral is different in the sense that, again, you'd had a general idea of what pace looks like between Max and Lewis in 2021 and also just how much further down the track they were at that point. I think there's slight differences and nuances there. And I think Lewis could have been a lot more fair in how he went down the inside in this particular instance. I think that's why you can sort of hark back to 2021 in that regard, being like, okay, you actually could have been more fair here. But again, with the context changes, because in 2021, it could have been Max, his reputation playing into why Lewis was so harsh. And here, it's a matter of Lewis's expectation being why he was so aggressive about taking that patch of tarmac. So yeah, I see why the similarity is there, but it's not entirely cut and paste.
I fully agree. Ngumisa, I want to bring you in now. You've been someone who, like you said, you've followed the sport quite keenly and have an interest in a variety of parts of the sport. I'm interested in your thoughts about the situation that we found ourselves going into for the race this weekend. So for people who didn't follow it that closely, on Friday after the practice, Pirelli inspects the tires after the session, but on Friday evening, which was now after qualifying even, it was discovered that there was some microscopic damage to the walls of the tires. And this indicates the onset of potential tire failure. And Pirelli, in their wisdom, after taking back another sample of tires at the end of the sprint race on the Saturday evening, decided on Sunday that we had to introduce regulations. So the regulations as they read by the book were that no single tire could do more than 18 laps. And a lot of us have said, well, you know, that's immediately a three-stopper, which it is if you do the numbers. But of course, we know from races like Japan last year that races can be shortened. Spa 2021, if anyone wants to, you know, be facetious about it. was that a race? But how did you feel, I think, firstly, about how the FIA handled that? How the race regulators handled that, and do you think it was the right thing to do in the interests of safety? And there's a reason I'm going to follow that up, but I've been long-winded already.
So I do think it was handled quite well. I think it was kind of difficult for Pirelli to judge what would happen with the tires because we haven't been there since 2021. The curbs had changed. There was new. They had like resurfaced the track. So it was kind of like unknown territory again for them. And I think they handled it quite well and quite swiftly. Like hearing on like Saturday morning that these are the steps we're going to take based on what happens during the sprint, I think was quite good of them. Yeah, I think it was just, they handled it quite well. I think we like to dunk on Pirelli because of like how bad their tires can be. But yeah, I think they handled...
There's no one who wants to do that more than me, I'll tell you.
Yeah, but I think they handled this weekend as best they could with what they had.
No, that's fair. And the reason I left the question at the place that I did at the time, and I mentioned that there's a follow-up, which is that the way I look at it, a decision was made for driver safety. And I do agree with you that procedurally and in terms of the final decision that was made, that the right decision was made. I would then like to ask you, how do you think and what do you think of a situation when it came to the race now? And perhaps it was an unintended consequence because the guys were going to push for essentially 57 quali laps because the tires were always going to last and there was suddenly no advantage to trying to manage your tires. We had Logan Sargeant retire to illness. We heard him in the laps before he did retire on the radio to his engineer complaining about illness. We've learned that Ocon vomited into his helmet, I think, on lap 14. Numerous other drivers, Alex Albon wasn't able to lift himself out of his car when he crossed the finish line. So we have a situation where the sport has recognized safety in the guise of tires, but when we should, is what, I guess maybe let me ask it this way. Was there any way for race control to handle the race differently once it became abundantly clear that people were getting sick and, you know, as the guys describe it, I guess, dizzying and sometimes not seeing out of these fast corners? So that, to me, that sounds more dangerous than the imminent threat of a potential failure.
Yeah, definitely. It is more dangerous. But what I like to say is that, like, racing drivers are going to race, I guess. And I don't think they would have wanted to stop the race necessarily. They did feel sick and stuff, and it is really upsetting to see that drivers were vomiting, and it is a huge concern. And I think it's something that maybe they can look forward to with regards to where do we place Qatar on the calendar, because I don't remember it being this bad the last time we raced there, but that was also in December when we raced there. So it was kind of like a weird situation, because, and you can't really say it was fully Formula One's fault, because sometimes they don't control when a race happens. If a promoter says, I want my race to happen in October, there's not really much Formula One can do if the promoter is paying for it, you know. So I think it's definitely something that they should look forward to for the next few years since we're racing there. But I think it was something that they didn't really expect. I think all the drivers were expecting the heat, but I don't think they really thought it was going to be this terrible.
Yeah, I think Prince, some might say that, you know, I think Lumisa made the point. First of all, you know, last time we raced here, it was slightly later in the year. I think it was towards the end of November, if not December, in 2021. But I wonder how much do you think of this was down to the fact, again, that the stints were capped at 18 laps, which meant that tire degradation was not as much of an issue. In fact, Verstappen came out after the race, and once it was commented about the fact that McLaren were only 4 seconds off the pace at the checkered flag, he argued that they had in fact been constrained by the maximum stint length, insofar as that one of the Red Bull's biggest strengths is how it looks after his tires. So given that tire degradation was not allowed to become an issue, if I could put it like that, the guys just went flat out. And there's some people might argue that, well, if guys were managing their tires, you know, as we stereotypically know in races now, then it would not have been that bad. Do you think this just reflects and gives us as viewers an insight into the difference and the level which these guys push in, you know, metaphorical and non-metaphorical quali laps?
Absolutely. That's a brilliant observation. And it's worth questioning. I think the issue with Formula One is that it's so complicated and it's constantly developing and changing that its guise is very difficult to alter when you just look at one element that you need to change to adapt to something. In this particular instance, we're looking at tire temperatures, degradation, and in hindsight, the health of racing drivers. So now to say, okay, we're going to shorten the stint length of these tires because Pirelli doesn't quite know what's going to happen beyond 18 or 19 laps, and we don't want to risk anything dangerous happening. So let's put a cap on that. But you're putting out, you're changing one element out of hundreds or thousands of moving pieces of what puts a Formula One race together. And to line it up with your question then, it definitely is difficult to gauge how much a driver is going to rein in their performance or how little they'll do so, given that they know I can actually wring this thing by the neck until the end of the stint. And it's exactly what they did, because I marveled at how it was purple sector after purple sector for, and it's an even spread across the top five or top six. Alonso a lot less, of course, but the McLarens, the Mercedes were there, George Russell. It's stint after stint. I think George, of course, had a four stint or something, five stint or whatever, something ridiculous like that because of the incident. He had to pit a lot earlier. But it was a marvel to see how long everyone could put in a very challenging lap time consistently throughout the lifespan, or the now shortened lifespan of the tires. So obviously that takes its toll on each of those racing drivers. And physically it's a lot tougher because obviously your grip level is a lot higher more consistently. And it's three times across in that race. So it definitely affects that. And it's, as much as it was a precaution to say, okay, for the sake of tire life and avoiding something dangerous happening, it's a massive moving sort of mechanism that you definitely will feel the domino effect of moving one piece and altering it. And this was the result of that. And it's something that really, I think, is inadvertent and unavoidable. And more than anything, it's just taking a lesson forward and seeing how to try and adapt to situations like that. But another thing I was thinking of is how, in a nutshell, and I tweeted about this actually, a sprint race and one of the hottest venues in the calendar is just nasty business. Like, what, you're just asking for trouble.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What the heck?
Like, yeah, you're quite right. And it's not just hot, but it's high speed corners. Like, yes, if you could imagine Monaco hypothetically was in Qatar and it was a night race, I don't think they come out as bruised as they did on yes, Sunday, just because of the nature of the track and, yes, and the much lower average speeds. For example, I think the last thing I would like to just comment about this is that I think there's a general, there are people who do advocate for 2 and 3 stop races. And there are also people who might point to the on-track action on Sunday as evidence of why we should move to, for example, a mandatory 3-stop. And I would just like to make a quick comment before we move on. I think, first of all, something that we need to be cognizant of is the broader point that you are making, Prince, which is that this is just one element of an extremely complex system, right? You move one thing and it changes a whole lot of other variables. Number one, the announcement, although teams may have started to prepare for this on Saturday, the announcement was made on Sunday, several hours before the race, which meant there was limited time for the strategy teams to figure out what they were going to do.
Yeah.
And I think if you were to mandate 3-stop races, these guys are so smart. Yes, it created a great on-track spectacle on Sunday, but it would only take these guys 2 or 3 races to figure out what's going on. And I think the final dynamic that a lot of people may not have fully appreciated was that the 18-lap maximum stint was across the tires as you had used them for the whole weekend. So if you were to mandate this, teams would simply alter the way that they use their tires if they know Sunday's outcome is going to be a particular way, because they didn't know this. They didn't even know this as a potential until sometime on Saturday. Then they would use their tires differently through the practice session. So again, it's always great to throw out ideas to debate them, but I do think we need to have some caveats and nuance to this whole idea of mandating 3 stops. For me personally, a parting shot on this, I believe variable strategies is always the way in which you actually produce great racing. I think, for example, the difference between Max and Lewis at Circuit of the America in 2021, where Max was on an impossible, well, he stopped, it was a 2-stop, but he stopped miles earlier than Hamilton, which meant that Hamilton was going to be able to come back at him at the end of the race. But anyway, that's not the most important thing to miss. I do want to ask your thoughts on the papaya McLaren. Oscar Piastri wins his first F1 event. I've heard people say it's a race. I don't know if it's a race, certainly not a Grand Prix, but let's say he wins his first F1 event on Saturday. It has felt like it's coming. The McLarens didn't qualify well for the Grand Prix, 6th and 10th, both of them having lap times deleted due to track limits on Friday. And we haven't even spoken about track limits. My goodness, I forgot about that. cost Sergio Perez, or he cost himself. But what are your reflections on McLaren and the job that they've done in 2023? I mean, this team was arguably the slowest car at Bahrain at the beginning of this year.
McLaren, I think, have been the biggest surprise for me for this year. I think even, like, them and Aston Martin are kind of on the same level of, like, shock about what happened this year. I don't even know how to describe, like, the trajectory that they've been on since Austria. And you always know Lando's going to go well at Austria. And then it just kept, like, building and building and building from there. To the point where, like, I think Lando's got as many, or if not one more podium than Sergio Perez has had this whole season. So it's really a true testament to, like, how much this team has, how much they were able to gather themselves up from the depths that they were in at the beginning of this year to the highs that they're currently in. I think if Red Bull had slightly less of a stronger car, we'd be having a great second half of the season.
We absolutely would. I actually saw the numbers that said it's four races ago. So I don't know what was four races ago. McLaren is outscoring Red Bull 104-75 in the Constructors' Championship since four races ago. So you do the count back for which was that fourth race. They're an unbelievable run. And I think something I've mentioned on the show before is that I deeply admire teams that can, number one, hold their hand up when they are wrong. Because McLaren, I don't know if you guys remember, just before even a single piece of rubber was laid in Bahrain, came out in the media and said, guys, we're changing our car, we're changing our concept. We've seen something that makes us very alive to the fact that we've messed it up. Now, some people might say, you know, that's just some PR, you know, they're just trying to manage expectations. But then they said, please wait to Austria, and they delivered. And I think, Prince, if I can throw this to you, one of the most impressive things about what McLaren have done is that almost every upgrade has worked. Because you look at Aston Martin, who brought a huge upgrade package in Canada, and they're now saying that upgrade package is what has taken us backwards. And really, we've seen, I don't think Alonso's been on the podium since Canada. I stand corrected, but like the general trend would be correct. They're just doing an incredible job, aren't they? But operationally, Sunday, we can't not comment this. A 1.8 second pit stop, a world record, the fastest pit stop on 18-inch rims. And they also had another 2 second pit stop, 2.00 flat. I'm not sure who the drivers were. I think it was Norris for the first one. I mean, that's a team that's operating at a level of excellence from the strategy department to the drivers, through to the pit crew.
It's incredible. The fact that, you know how difficult it is for a Formula One team to pivot on their philosophy at short notice and actually get it right and set realistic timelines that they actually achieve. I think that is the masterstroke in their, you know, in their shining and working through their trouble this year and getting to the point where they are. As Ngumi said, from Austria onwards, it was just, you know, upward trajectory. The fact that they could turn around and say, you know what, we got it wrong, we need to change our hydrate very early on in the year, that for me, I think, is what changed everything. Because if you look at the common factor when it comes to teams that are struggling to get the right platform and get that sweet spot in terms of performance, Mercedes are bemoaning, have been bemoaning the same thing about ride highs for the past couple of years. And that, I think, is a common trend throughout in establishing how you can get the most efficient package aerodynamically and meld that nicely with your power unit. So the fact that they quickly recognized we need to change this and get into that window of performance made everything else a lot easier because the platform is a lot more solid. So by the time Austria came around, I think that's where it's like, oh, you just fingers crossed that everything you've projected is going to come together. And it did. And from then, it's just, you know, a smooth sailing. Then they worked on getting their car better around slower corners, because that's been a sort of chronic weakness that the cars had. And bit by bit, all of that is just coming together. I think it's just time. It's putting time into the project. It's been a long time coming. It has been a couple of years, and they've been pumping a lot of money into their facilities. And they have to make sure they get it right this year, because remember also, capital expenditure is changing based on performance. It's now a sliding scale based on how successful you are. So the more they get to be a threat to Red Bull, the less money they're going to be getting going forward to beef up their facilities. So I think it's also that pressure that Stella and the entire team has to make sure that they get it right now, when they can spend as much money as possible on developing their team and being the underdogs. Because that tag wears away quickly in F1, and you're quickly public enemy number one now if you're successful. You know what I mean? So,
I mean, look at Aston Martin, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, it's incredible how quickly, and I think the point that you're making. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I just think the point that you're making about the capital expenditure stuff, I believe. Oof, and I hope I'm not getting my numbers wrong, but I think it's 51 million, whether it's dollars or pounds, to Red Bull, Ferrari, and Mercedes. And it's based on constructors finishing. And then I think there's 59 million to the midfielders, which I think McLaren and Aston Martin are part of that group. And then there's 60-something million available to the teams at the back. Again, I'm calling this off the top of my head, but I think what you're saying is very important, because the moment you become a front-running team, that budget will be slashed, and so they need to make the most of this. But I mean, we've got to, you can only put your hands up and applaud them, because I think
absolutely
absolutely. But I would like to Ngumisa and bring you in, because we've been talking about teams doing well. We've spoken about the FIA and how they were managing the sport on this weekend, looking after drivers, looking after the integrity of the tires and driver safety. Something that's making a few teams, and I don't know if the drivers will feel unsafe or they will welcome this, is the possible introduction of Andretti Global into Formula One. So for people who haven't been following this, there's a two-step process into becoming a Formula One team. And the first phase involves an invite from the FIA for teams to put their bids together. And then they do present to the FIA on why they should be gained entry into Formula One. And then once that has been approved, Formula One or FOM, Liberty, or whoever, you know, the Formula One stakeholders, because the FIA is the overarching body for all of motorsport, right? It's not just the Formula One thing. Of course, Formula One is their biggest child, if I could put it like that. So Andretti has got through the FIA stuff, but everything that we're hearing, Ngumisa, is that F1 itself, the teams, the sponsors, are not that keen on Andretti joining the sport. I think I would be correct in saying that the fans want this. Where do you lie? And if I could put you a little bit on the spot, how do you think this ends? How do you think this ends up for Andretti? Will we have an 11th car in 2025, 11th team?
This is a very, it's kind of like a weird situation. And I don't really buy the excuses that the team principals are giving. I understand where they're coming from in terms of losing money, especially the smaller teams, because they rely on that money to survive. But yeah, I just don't really buy the everything is good, let's not change it, or, you know.
yeah, that's exactly what they're saying.
So
okay, is it really that good?
You know, I think they're trying to, I don't know what they're trying to do, but I don't buy it. I think an 11th team would be great. We've seen it done before. And I think it would be different to the times it was done before, because we actually have a cost cap now. In 2010, they promised a cost cap to those new teams, but they never got it. And JT is bringing GM in the form of Cadillac to, like, supply their engine. So it's not like they're short on money. So I don't think it would be, we'd be having the same kind of issues that we had, that we have seen before. I would love an 11th team, more drivers, you know, more jeopardy for the teams. It's just fun when there's more, you know.
Yeah.
More is great. Yeah. Especially when it comes to Formula One, I think we've all been, like, yearning for an 11th team, and this is such a great opportunity, I think. And I know everyone's tired of speaking about them, but they do provide, like, a window for American fans, especially if you're into IndyCar.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Like, oh, I'm going to follow my team into Formula One. And I don't think it hurts that much if they're pushing 3 Grand Prix in the US, having an actual American team, not like what Haas is doing.
That's a great point.
Will be great. The teams are very, I think they're just very protective of their product. I understand where James was coming from in terms of they can't afford to have their money diluted. But I think with the $600 million that they're going to pay anyway, I think it's coming back to them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Prince, I want to bring you on this because Nomisa just started to speak about this. So much of the conversation seems to be around money and not reducing value. Or rather, the teams are saying, what value will this 11th team, whether it's Andretti or LKY Sons or whoever the case it may be, right? What value do they bring? But I think she alluded to something quite interesting, which is, what value does Haas bring? I mean, Haas is an American team, and yet here we are all talking as if there is no American team on the grid, right? And a $600 million, and I forget, whether it's dollars or pounds, but $600 million in either of those currencies, anti-dilution fund over 5 years, surely does enough to keep the teams happy. And as far as we are hearing, or that we hear, Formula One has never been better, right? It's never been in greater health financially and as a product. So what do you make of the arguments that are being presented against the introduction of Andretti? And do you believe them?
Bigger is better. And I don't think anyone understands it more than Americans. They do it big in all of their disciplines and all of their sports franchises. So it's always a good thing to have them around when it comes to, like, commercializing or maximizing the commercial potential of a product. But just to segue very quickly in and out on the Haas thing, I think Haas is definitely sort of a side project for Gene, or personal project for Gene Haas himself. And it's reflected in what's going on with him and Gunther at the moment, the whole ownership tiff that he and him are having as to whatever the verbal agreement was about ownership of the team. I think that in itself reflects the level of commitment to what Haas want to do for Formula One, which is, I think, very little, as opposed to playing the team game and being a part of the posse that's, you know, the little clique that Formula One is, really, because it is a faction thing. And I don't think Gene Haas is necessarily that ingrained into the system to the extent where he'd be able to, or allow for, like, someone like a Gunther Steiner to get that ownership of the team, because I think Gunther would have a lot more pull than Haas. But that's all in theory, really. There's nothing that would corroborate that to be a fact. But
but I mean, everything that we all say here, you know, there's very few that we know in fact, so you don't even have to
fair.
Put a caveat out there.
Fair,
you're being
fair.
Very unkind to yourself. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're just trying to string together fast moving objects a lot of the time. So in terms of now the viability of this, I think, again, it's definitely viable. It's just that Liberty has to be smart in how they dissolve the old Formula One system. Because Formula One is only, in my opinion, becoming a proper corporation now, like in this era, where it's being a bit more transparent in the systems, in the governance, in the commercial, you know, the commercial side of it, and our team's actually making money and it's sustainability. And you can see that teams are used to that old system that Bernie Eccleston and the boys had established, and they were happy with it because it kept things steady. Now Liberty Media is coming in with, oh, we've got new friends and new packages, new toys, and it could very easily flood what the traditional teams are used to, and they're uncomfortable with that, you know? So the negotiation process for that transition needs to be like really smart and really good. And you can see that the lines are so like deeply dug, the trenches are so deeply dug in the ground. When you look at how, for example, the Andretti and Cadillac party is coming and being led by Mohammed Ben Sulayem, which is rather interesting. Of course, he's FIA and they have to have first dibs on the approval process, but you know his history over the past couple of years, and now it's not been exactly friendly with him and Stefano Domenicali, and the whole who owns Formula One argument and the little tiff they had when he was like, okay, FIA actually owns the franchise and you guys are just running it on our behalf. You know, so things like that kind of tell you that it's not going to be very nice. It's not going to be very easy for Cadillac to come in and do this. It definitely will be successful when it happens for Andretti and Cadillac. I have no doubt about that. But the politics could easily ruin it or destroy the potential of that happening. I think that's the part that will be very, as opposed to some, interesting to see how that materializes. But as for, look, the bigger the better, more races, more venues, and Americans know how to do it, I think, better than anyone else in the world. So they're absolutely perfect for this.
Yeah, I hear you fully, and so I'm interested because there are some, we're talking about the politics, and I think Prince did sum it up quite beautifully, particularly between the power struggle between the FIA and FOM. You actually jolted a memory in my mind that I'm not remembering clearly, but was there not something earlier this year where it was said that Mohammed Ben Sulayem will no longer talk on F1 or something like that? Was it like, weren't they fighting and throwing dummies at each other?
I think he said he would step back from Formula One and focus on the other FIA project. I think he can still speak on Formula One because he is the president of the FIA. It's like, you know, F1 is their main cash cow. So yeah, it's very interesting. And speaking on like what Prince said, I do think it will get ugly. I think if Andretti is denied, we could see a court case because they desperately want to come into Formula One. And from what I've heard, it's going to be very, very, very tough for them to get in. So, yeah, it is going to, I think I agree with Prince, it is going to turn ugly. I don't see a way this goes very well.
But something to keep your look out for is, and again, I don't speak as an authority on this, but having read one or two things, there is an argument that with the FIA and Formula One being based, is it in France, that they are governed by EU laws, right? As mm-hmm. as a sport within multiple jurisdictions, and apparently. At the basic level, at this point, now that the FIA has granted Cadillac and Andretti permission to join. It basically, it would be deemed anti-competitive and therefore illegal for Formula One to not let them in. And what I think we may want to keep an eye out for is this whole fight being played out very, very publicly. Because, you know, throughout the process, it kind of went, I think a couple of us might have even forgotten about it after a while. But I think that's probably why, even before the formal process was begun, there was a lot of public jockeying, because I think Cadillac understood and Michael Andretti understood that if we get past the FIA, it's going to be impossible for F1 to do it. But then, of course, how do you enter a sport so begrudged where everyone hates you? I mean,
exactly.
I'm a Red Bull guy. If they want to hate someone else, if they want to talk about someone else for a while, then I am totally down for that. Because, you know, someone else can take the heat for a little while. But I think that's probably to segue into the last thing. It's quite interesting. You know, it was a really interesting race. We haven't really touched on Ferrari, who, by the way, also did a 1.93 second pit stop. Sorry, man. Ideas just keep popping to me. Prince.
What's up?
We had three pit stops on Saturday that were 2 seconds or faster. McLaren 1.8, Ferrari 1.93, McLaren again 2.00. We actually had AlphaTauri at 2.19 seconds. I must admit, personally, I missed the Ferrari and AlphaTauri pit stops. But do you think that so many exceptional pit stops have anything to do with the conditions? Would it even make sense, or are we just seeing teams and pit crews continuously up their game? Because that's remarkable. I don't think we've ever seen so many exceptional pit stops in one race.
It was quite weird to see, actually. It was like there was another race, a pit stop race happening beside the actual race. So I suppose it's hard to separate the two, because the times are dropping so frequently. But I think also, a pit stop is a lot more of a rare occurrence, I suppose, in traditional strategic circumstances. So like if you have one or a two stopper, you only have one or two chances to nail it. But when you realize how much of a difference it makes and how much it counts for the race, given that you've got a multiplied number of stints now, I think teams were like, okay, guys, we actually got to nail this, because everything's riding on this. So better up your game. And you saw how it was a gradual thing. It went from, I mean, the fact that when you look at the 1.8 that was set by McLaren, that was the second pit stop. It was a lap later than the 2 second or 2.1 by Piastri. So it was, Piastri being the lead driver, you'd think it was him who would get that one, but it was actually Lando Norris. So it was a gradual thing. The more they did it, the better they got at it. And effectively, if you have two drivers, then you're doing about six pit stops or so, if I'm not mistaken. So you see, there's plenty of time for you to actually practice and get it right. You know, I think they got in more pit stop practice than on a normal Grand Prix weekend. So Kota is going to be a fun place to be, actually.
Oh yeah, that's going to be amazing. It's one of my favorite races for the year. But Numisa, again, I've had you guys for an hour, and I really don't want to. I feel like we could speak for a long time, and there's many things that we won't discuss here. But a quick word to Red Bull and Verstappen. He somehow, within all the chaos, manages to take the checkered flag on Sunday quite without any issue, you know. I think we heard GP shouting at him again, his engineer, GMP Lambiasi, at some point during the weekend, but nothing major. Any thoughts on that, firstly? And secondly, I'd just like your reflections, please, on where you think the sport is, and I'm, you know, sort of to be, if you want to have a note for all these questions that I'm asking. I'm just interested in your experience. You started watching the sport in 2013, in Malti 21. Red Bull and Sebastian Vettel at that time were dominating the sport. They won 9 races in a row, a world record up until a few weeks ago. What kept you glued to the sport, you know, for the 10 years since? And where do you see the sport heading after this year and such a really emphatic performance by Red Bull, probably not seen since 2013? You can answer one or none of those at the end of the day.
I'll start with Max. What more can you say that hasn't been said, really? I think the only way to describe Max like this year is inevitable. He's just going to be there no matter what happens, no matter what setback. He is going to be the winner. He's going to fight for the win. And it's been incredible to watch his season. I think someone on Twitter mentioned that this is like one of the best 3-year runs we've ever seen. Counting 2021, the 10 race wins, and like the fact that he barely finished off the podium. Last year, 15 wins, most wins we've ever seen in a season. This year, the 11 race streak. And what's he on now? Like 14 wins?
No, it ended. Yeah, 14 overall. Yeah.
So I think we're watching one of the best runs I think we've ever seen in Formula One. There's nothing you can really do but like tip your hat to him, you know, if you like him or not. You just gotta say like, job well done. You don't have to, but I mean, you know, it's an amazing thing that we're witnessing. And it's not just him. Sorry, I'm just gonna speak for a while. Not just him. It's like the way Red Bull is running. Like the pit stops, always you'll always find them as one of the best pit stops. The strategy department, you never see them really get anything wrong. So I think Max and Red Bull are just like gelling so well right now. I think it's a great job that they've done. In terms of the future of the sport, it's a difficult one because I remember there was a point, I think it was like 2014-ish. It was just before Bernie sold the sport to Liberty Media. There were a lot of discussions about like, what does the sport look like? Like who, like there were discussions about like, no newer fans are coming in, there are no younger fans coming in. And people were scared about like the future of the sport because all the fans of the sport were like 60. And Bernie was like dead set on not having younger fans because young fans can't buy Rolex, you know?
So yeah, and he was like 85. But you're right, that's literally what he said. He's honestly senile. I'm sorry.
So there was a point where I was also like afraid of like, what would the sport become? It's this thing that I've grown to love. It's, you know, everything that I like. It's fast cars. It's the best drivers. It's teamwork, but not teamwork, you know. It was, you know, when you just find something you love and you can't even explain why you like it so much. It's just
100%.
You love this thing, you know. So I think we are in a healthy spot as the sport. And it's difficult to really tell like what's gonna happen. Because so many things have changed and the DTS, I was about to say DTM, so like I had to stop myself. The drive to the room has kind of like lulled a bit. So the sport really has to figure out where do they want to put their attention. And I think they really need to focus on getting more, like working more with like content creators, because they bring a sort of like humanness to the sport. They're not really like reporters. They don't really have to be like unbiased or whatever. So I think there really needs to be more of a fan-centered approach to the sport. Even though, I don't know if you read the report, there was this, I don't even know where it was from, but...
I remember it.
I'm
sorry to cut you off, but you both, please hold the thought, Nomisa, but you okay. both... You both, do you guys remember the Viceroy report on Capitec stocks a couple of years ago? I know I'm getting into my nerd era now. Do you guys remember that thing? that
I remember social the media about report. It, no specifics.
Yeah. This report reminded me a lot about that. But again, Lumisa, sorry. I hope you've held your thoughts. Yeah.
No, it's okay. The fact that almost 98% or something of fans will never see a Formula One race live. So I think they really need to tap into bringing events to places where there aren't races. So it's things like that where they need to just be more engaging with the fan base in a way that's not only around a Grand Prix.
I think that's such an astute, that's such a lovely point, because I'd never really thought about it like that. The fact that so many of us will never get to a Grand Prix, except for us, not us though. So I think Grand Prix will happen when, a geopolitical situation changes. But Prince, again, with you, just to round it up, your feelings on the sport, the season, the floor is yours, whether that's how you're feeling about Max's dominance or anything like that, or even the political situation in the sport. We still, we're still clinging on to Hamilton as the only black driver. We had Jessica Hawkins do a test about a month ago now for Aston Martin. Yeah. So that speaks to issues of inclusivity across gender and racial lines. Where are you with your relationship with the sport at the moment?
Ooh, firstly, a fantastic observation made by Nomi about the potential that the sport needs to tap into with regard to people that will never see the cars in the metal, and that primarily is their market. And if the sport's idea of spreading and dominating as a brand and as a product is going all over the world, the fastest way to do that is digitally. And no one owns the digital space more than content creators, whether that's on like a professional or just hobbyist level. So it's definitely a fantastic way to sum it up, Nomi. But thinking generally though, but like politically and the way the sport is going, I guess it would be refreshing to take that stance, because we've all harped on about how fascinated we are about the sport. And to talk about things that touch on the human side of it, I think is important. And I was thinking about how Jessica Hawkins and how impressive she was. I hear that she was actually quicker than Aston Martin's reserve driver in that test. She set more impressive lap times, which is very interesting to hear. And I think she really is an important figure for the sport, if enough attention is paid to her being there, because we've had similar instances, for example, Susie Wolf at some point, Tatiana Calderon, I think more significantly Susie Wolf, but more recently Calderon with Alfa Romeo, but not enough attention was paid to their presence in the sport. And I think representation across the spectrum. So we do want to see more female drivers, but we also want to see more female executives as well in the sport, and also more female regulators as well in the sport, because that helps sway the narrative a lot easier from the top down. I don't see a quick move towards diversity if you're not seeing the people we're trying to represent as drivers being represented as regulators or people in the commercial space or people in any other arena of the sport that helping put it together. I don't see that as going to happen as naturally as we think it will. It's going to be a very violent process and pretty much pushing against an immovable object. That's just my take on transformation and diversity. But in terms of the presence of Lewis Hamilton in the sport, same thing, really. If you're not going to be seeing more Black people, people of color, different groups ethnically in more positions than just the driving position, nothing is going to change at the most visible level, which is the 20 cars going round and round, going vroom vroom, as we might say it. It's just it's just that simple. You know, we need it across the spectrum. And I think people like Lewis Hamilton and people who will come after him may have seen that and voice it, that, okay, being a driver is not the only thing. There's more to it. And we have to open up those spaces. And we've started to see that transformation. I remember at some point there was, I didn't get to see the reporter, but I could hear he had an African inflection in his accent. So he's from the UK, but I could hear there's a Black man interviewing. And he was speaking to Fernando Alonso, right? And I was like, oh, snap, a Black dude is interviewing someone in Formula One. How great. And it was his first weekend out there. But the treatment Alonso gave him during that interview was just, and it was, yes, it was the weekend when Alonso was celebrating something, an anniversary or some record. And I'm pretty sure he had answered the question so many times that by the time he got to him, it's like, ah, this question again. But I've seen many drivers treat that instance more graciously and receive it more graciously. I was so pissed at how he did that.
I understand, yeah.
I was so pissed at how he did that because that was a huge moment potentially for that guy to, like, I guess, gain a more confident stride in the transformation journey, whatever, for the sport. Generally, as a whole, it didn't really sit well. It left a very bitter taste. But things like that, getting more people of color into the space, Naomi getting there, you know, South African being there, that's been great over the past couple of years. All those things need to happen, like, more consistently. And I think that's what's ultimately going to transform the face of the sport. What people see and can relate to, if that changes more often then great. You know, the rest is out of our hands. The rest is just as good as a series. It's like watching Billions, you know. That's what I do.
Billions. Billions.
I don't binge on series. I just watch this Formula One stuff and watch these people fight and count their money. That's entertainment. You know? So yeah, man, that's pretty much. That's my thrill.
It's amazing. No, you two have both been absolutely phenomenal. I mean it sincerely that I would love to chat to both of you more in the future. It's a pity Wame couldn't be here because I know that she had some very large issues on her chest about this past weekend, but she'll be back after COTA. You know, some of your reflections, like, leave me inspired that we will get there. I think, you know, in terms of representation and inclusivity, the sport isn't there, but we will get there. And the product itself, you know, I think what Ngumi was observing about, you know, Max is actually genuinely on quite an all-time run. It has to come to an end, right? I think Schumacher won 5 drivers' championships in a row, but Hamilton also was pipped at 4. Some will say 5. I know it's political, but you know, I think the don't end is that history tells us. History tells us that, you know, this level of dominance and concentration, and maybe he'll just get bored, is bound to end. I think we're closer to the end. Yeah. Than we are to the beginning. But thank you to the both of you. Thank you for availing yourselves your time. I know I've taken more time than we had agreed initially, but you guys have stayed on graciously and patiently, and have a lovely evening. All the best, and please can we chat again soon?
Thank you.
Oh geez, thank you. It's been such a pleasure being here. Thank you to you both.